G'day, and thanks for joining us for another Australia Talks, the official podcast of the r/Australian subreddit. I'm DK, and I'm joined, as always, by my lovely co-host, Ardeep. Today is Thursday, the 18th of April, 2024, and our topics this week are: a Queensland-based company is ready to launch into space.
And
space and the CSIRO survey finds most Australians are unwilling to pay for climate change. We'll get into the meat of that one a little bit later on. Of course, we've got our Two Ticks Town Talk in between, and then we're going to jump into This Week in Australian History with our Deet, and we'll finish off, as always, with a Forex bottle top question. And I'll be honest, I'm a little bit scared. I threw you some really difficult questions last week, so stick around to the end of the show for that. But before we get into all of that, let's catch up on the last week. Ardeet, what's been going on with you?
G'day, DK. Well, what's been going on the last few days is been getting our driveway topped up and fixed up. So we've got from our front gate to the garage, the driveway is it's probably about 110 metres or something like that. And we've had it with the crushed rock, so it's almost like road base, somebody will call it. So it's like a bluey grey type of rock, and over the 12 years it's been down, it's just gradually got sort of powderier. So you know, it gets sort of stuck in your shoes and drag all these bloody little rocks into the driveway, and we just thought, oh bugger it, time to get it topped up. So we've gone away from the packed rocks to these little round rocks instead, which look really nice and match part of the brickwork under the at the bottom of the house around the plinth. So that's been – bloke was here for about 2.5 days. He has to sort of scrape it and then move stuff around, get it all ready, get in the – we ended up using 24 meters of rock to do the turning circle and the drive. So that was a fair bit of rock, which adds up. But we did have, we've got the driveway, so like it's just normal sort of looking drive up to the turning circle in front of the garage. And I calculated the square meters of the turning circle. I thought, shit, that's a lot of, there was something, I can't remember, it was something like 600 square meters or wow. Something like that. It was like 30 something by 60, 50 something, or something, whatever it was a figure that astounded even me. And we thought, oh, we'll check out what it's cost to get pebblecrete. And the pebblecrete, the guy, once we worked out the price per meter, it was going to be something like $55,000.
Wow.
Just for the turning circle. And we thought, wow. No, we won't be doing that. We thought, well, look, let's just get it topped up. Got some nice stuff in there. So that was good. Good seeing the bloke doing it. I had a bit of machine envy of his. Like when he pulled up the first day with his equipment, he was in the car and I just went straight past him in the car. Like he had one of those Dodge Rams because he was pulling this big trailer. Just went straight to his equipment at the back. Yeah, he was doing something in the car. It wasn't quite ignoring him, but I thought, well, you stay in the car. I want to have a look at what you've got. And it looks – it's a similar set up to a dingo, but it's like a dingo on steroids. You stand on the back of it, but it's like much bigger. This one was a Toro. And there's apparently a European version of it, and it looks like it's about almost as powerful as like a little bobcat, similar size bucket. And that was pretty full on. But the way that he then had the front part of his trailer set up, it had the, because as you know, you can take the bucket off and connect the other attachment, and then slot it in. That was a trench tool, and then on the crossbar of the trailer was a whole lot of augers and the auger driver, and so he could actually just go in and lift up the whole thing with the forklift and the trenching tool and the stump grinder if you wanted to be putting a load into a trailer. It was just so well designed, and it had so many good toys on there. I just looked at it and I was thinking, oh, God, I'd love to have something like that. It was really, really, I like your toys.
I know exactly what you mean. A good friend of mine, I had to help him out. We didn't get someone to do it, but we did the same sort of thing. We'd redo the driveway, the gravel on the driveway. Got a couple of truckloads, and he hired essentially what you've described is sort of a bigger dingo. I think they call them like a tracked loader or something like that.
Okay. Yep.
They're like a mini bobcat that you stand on, but they're bigger than the dingo. Yep. They're sort of in between, and I had the best day driving that thing around. I was a whiz on it. I was like, you never ever see an angry like heavy machinery operator. They're always having the best times because it's just so much fun. And I said to my mate, he's got a reasonably large property, and I said to him, I was like, oh, wouldn't having one of these be just so much fun and also like so useful around the property? And he's like, absolutely. He had it for a couple of days, and we were using it all over the property for different things, but initially it was for the gravel. But once you've sort of got it, you realize, you know, oh, hang on, I can use it for this, and I can use it for this, and da 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 da. And it's got all the attachments and things like that. And I said to him, I was like, oh, maybe we should, you know, just look at, you know, getting one. How much should they be?
Exactly.
So we did look it up. It was something around, I think it was $75,000 for a second-hand one that was reasonably new. It was only a couple of years old. And that very quickly stopped that conversation because, you know, for that amount of money, you could buy, like, a mini excavator is a lot cheaper than that. So, and probably more useful in some ways. But it was a cool couple of days to drive it around and kind of go berserk on it. So.
Oh, bloody oath. Oh, I'm envious you got to drive it. So, yeah. Look, you're right. While he was doing that stuff, I was doing stuff in the garden. We'd got in about 10 meters of mulch I had to spread, and there was a delay on the delivery of the rocks. So I'd just been using the ride-on mower. I've got a little trailer that hooks onto the back of that and, you know, pitchforking mulch into it. And so when we were waiting, he said, oh, do you want me to just dump stuff where you need mulch, where you need it with the bucket. So for sure, it probably took about, without exaggeration, probably took about 15% of the time it would have taken me for doing it manually. It was just like power. I got through all the mulch, so I was a happy chappy.
It's definitely one of those things that when you have a tool like that, you realize basically why we use them. Because you're right, it's you know, one man can do the work of 10 or 50 men in a day, and, you know, barely crack a sweat. It's a complete changer, a game changer in terms of efficiency output that one person can do. Almost frustratingly so, especially, you know, for little jobs like that, where next time you go and do the mulch, you'll be kicking yourself going, should I hire one for the day? I do want to say it wasn't as expensive as I thought it was. I think it was about $400 or $500 for the day, for the one we hired, which, I don't know, depending on what you've got to do, may or may not be value, you know, might not be worth it, but it was definitely an enjoyable day to do that.
What have you been up to?
Well, we recently purchased a new couch, and anyone that's ever had to go through the absolute horrible displeasure of moving house will understand how annoying removing a couch and putting a new couch in. Basically, the biggest problem was that it was a fair distance away we'd got to get it from, and piled it up all on the trailer. Didn't think it was going to fit, but we made it work, and got it home, and it didn't fit through the door.
Oh, no.
So we managed, we eventually did manage to get it in, sort of doing a bit of tricky geometry. But I'll tell you what, if you're listening to this and you are building a house, I don't care when you listen to this. It could be in 5 years' time, 100 years' time. If you're listening to this and you are building a house, do yourself a favor. You don't need a tall door. You need a wide door or a double door, you know. I'm kicking myself because when we built this house, we had the option of having sort of like a, almost like a half door. So it could have been 1.5 doors, or we could have gone for a window next to the door, and we picked the window. And now I wish we didn't pick the window and I wish we had that other small little door that's, you know, it seems useless, but when you're moving something through that door, is very, very useful. So if you're listening to this and you're building a house and you're umming and ahhing about whether or not you need a big door, the answer is yes. It doesn't need to be tall. It needs to be wide.
I would second that. We've got a double door on the front door. And look, you still have to handle the hallways. But when you need that extra bit of room, it's really worth it. So how did you actually get it in?
We basically sort of did a bit of tricky geometry, turning it around and sort of fitting it in, and then halfway through the door sort of turning it and shuffling it, and it was a nightmare, but we got it in. And I'm terrified of when we move and have to move it out because it's not going to be good. I think I might take it out the back, and I think it'll be easier to go over my back fence. If I can put a trailer behind there and pack it on that way rather than trying to get it back through the front door. It was wrapped in plastic, so we could kind of be a bit rough with the door without worrying about damaging anything. But of course, now it's not. So, look, that's a problem for DK in the future. That's future DK's problem. But yeah. I'm not looking forward to that day when it comes along.
Well, I suppose if you can get a couch through the door, they can get a rocket into space.
That's what they say. So Bowen Orbital, they're at their spaceport. They're ready to launch Gilmore Space's first Ares rocket. And when brothers Adam and James Gilmore came up with the plan to build and launch the first Australian-made orbital rocket, people thought they were crazy. I'm sure some people still think they are. But nearly a decade later, the pair are preparing to send their 23-meter rocket into low Earth orbit from this North Queensland town. The journey to blast Australia into the global space race has taken them from the Gold Coast factory to a warehouse nestled in the mountain bushlands in Bowen, just south of the town of Townsville. Founded in 2013, Gilmore Space began with a small team of about a dozen people. Now, it employs just under 200 engineers, manufacturers, and technicians who have spent the past 3 years piecing together the 30,000 kilogram Ares rocket that's cost more than $100 million. So I hope it doesn't explode on the launch pad. For the first time, the rocket has successfully been lifted into its vertical position on the launch pad at the newly opened Bowen Orbital Spaceport. Its anticipated liftoff will be attempted early in May, once it has been granted the final authorization from the Australian Space Agency. An agency spokesman said the assessment process remains in work. They will not give away any secrets. Gilmore is working closely with the Office of the Space Regulator to ensure that the launch meets the requirements, they've said. The unpiloted rocket will pass over the Coral Sea before entering low Earth orbit, a trip that is expected to take 8 minutes. With a population of only around 10,000 people, the coastal town of Bowen is better known for its gateway to the famous Whitsundays, and was also the backdrop to Baz Luhrmann's film Australia. So it seems like a bit of a weird spot. However, it's actually a really good spot for launching because the closer you are to the equator, the less fuel you have to burn to sort of catch up to Earth's orbital velocity, if you like. Mayor Ryan Collins said he was hoping to establish a permanent base for rocket launches and it would be a draw card for tourists. A second launch is anticipated later this year, and once Gilmore Space had succeeded in reaching orbit, James Gilmore said they would look at manufacturing a rocket capable of carrying humans. He said, I'd like to prove that there are employment opportunities, particularly for Queenslanders, to come and join the space race in their backyard. This is something I had never heard about until I read about it just the other day. New Zealand kind of famously has their own small commercial rocket or space flight sort of industry where they launch small, what we call sort of like CubeSats, like very small satellites into low Earth orbit and things like that. It's great to see an Australian company basically following, I don't want to say in their footsteps, but along the same line of work, I guess. The fact that they have very lofty ambitions to send humans on one of their spacecrafts is kind of insane in my mind. But how do you feel about this?
Well, I think probably both you and I have got the big kevs about this one. I like that, well, Australians arguably are catching up to New Zealand in this one. I find it exciting. I also think it's necessary moving in, you know, looking at the next 50 years, 40, 50 years to have this capability. There were three things that I particularly liked about this. The one that I think is an important one is from that article that you read, they'd said that they've had to educate everybody from local government, state and federal about what it means to launch rockets from Australia. And to my mind, this is arguably one of the most important pioneering aspects of this adventure, you know, launching a rocket of information deep into the gloomy darkness of bureaucracy and paving a path, making it easier for others to follow. They're doing a lot of hard work getting bureaucracy used to this sort of thing happening, which means their next flight should be a bit easier, flights after that will be a bit easier, and then the inevitable competition, and I hope we get competition because it's successful. Yeah. They're going to just be able to follow in the footsteps of these people. So I think that's an important aspect of this, which is not particularly glamorous, but I think it's vital. I also thought it was interesting how it gave us insight into how big this industry can be and the type of high-level expertise it can bring into the country. They said they had 200 engineers, manufacturers, and technicians, and they've been working past three years. That's a lot of skilled people working on something. I mean, that's good expertise to have in the country.
Yeah, it's very good, especially when we were sort of linking back to what we've spoken about before in terms of the defense industry sort of getting ramped up in Australia with the manufacturing of certain rocket munitions and things like that. I feel like is also going to sort of lend into possibly more commercial space industry as well. There's a lot of overlap between military rockets and civilian and research use rockets. I mean, the space race was basically that initially back in the 60s, wasn't it? So I think it's quite good from that aspect as well, sort of building a new industry. And I do have to take my hat off to Gilmore Space. As you said, they're really paving the way for others to come along to force the regulators into understanding what's going on.
Yep.
You know, there has been space flight missions from Australia in the past, like back in the 1950s, but they were like UK based. You know, it was a lot of the United Kingdom's sort of nuclear research, ballistic missile technology, and that a lot of it was test fired in Australia. Of course, you know, some of those skills sort of did transfer to Australia and to Australians. However, that kind of went nowhere. So a lot of that was kind of wasted, I think, a wasted potential in the past. Yeah. And, you know, times have changed a lot since the 1950s. So you kind of basically have to start from scratch. And it is, it's really cool that they're doing it. I think this is really great that we're also, you know, a little bit of state pride. It's a Queensland company paving the way for the rest of Australia. Yeah. Though Queensland is the best positioned part of Australia for this to occur. You sort of want to be close to the equator, as close as you reasonably can get. That still has all of those infrastructure links, of course. And you want for us, we want to fire in an eastward trajectory. So unfortunately, Western Australia is not particularly good because if something goes wrong, the rocket's going to come down over the Australian continent.
Good point.
Yeah, because you want to go with
the spin of the earth.
Yeah, so you want to launch in that eastward direction. So really, it kind of has to happen in Queensland. Unfortunately, for all you other states out there, sorry, losers, you're in the wrong place. If you want to go to space, you got to get to Queensland.
That could change sometime in the future, but once it sort of gets established. But that's a great point. Also, too, when you've got that number of people working for you, you don't really want a fly in, fly out type of situation. You want something where people can really settle down, get their teeth into it. I imagine the amount of work that would be required with that to be able to have someone go home to their family or go home to a nice location nearby, I think would be very important and would probably be motivating to a lot of people. And it's a sort of selling point to people to come and work for you. Because if this grows, I mean, if they've got that many engineers just to sort of get this happening and it grows into a design, manufacture, and launch industry, aside from getting the growth around there, you're going to be attracting a whole lot of people, and there's going to be a lot of people who want to have a little bit of luxury because they're bloody sweating over heavy details during the day.
Exactly. And look, this has been going on overseas for quite a while. As you said, they've been designing and testing things and everything like that. So I think being in Bowen is sort of that nice middle ground. You could go further north. You could go a lot further north. But the further north you go in Queensland, you do start hitting real remoteness kind of issues. Cairns is very isolated. That's sort of the next major place. I also feel like there's not a great area to launch from there because Cairns is surrounded by a lot of national parks and things like that. So there's probably not enough space, which is probably why they've gone to Bowen, which, as I said, it's just outside of Townsville. So, having I think they've been quite smart about where they've positioned this initially because there's enough room there for expansion. There's also, I believe it's a deep water port there as well. So they can bring in. They can, because I think coal goes out from that area. So there's like a rail link already. There's a deep water port. Once you start putting these ingredients in, it kind of just makes sense that you'd go there. And this could be a massive industry for not just Australia, but and Queensland. Because look at Cape Canaveral in Florida, yep, in the US. It's an international tourist destination. People come from all over to go there.
I'd love to see a rocket that size take off for sure.
Exactly. And there is a lot of room out near Bowen that they can expand into and everything like that. So I think that strategic positioning was quite good. These guys do seem to know what they're doing, which is really, really good. You kind of don't want, you know, the alternative is not so great. They know what they're doing. The rocket, everything looks good. Like, I'm excited to see.
They did expect it to blow up the first time. I thought there was something that I know you said, I hope it doesn't blow up, but I think there was something I read, I don't know if that was an article or somewhere else, where they said, look, generally the first couple of the rockets do tend to blow up. It'd be great if it worked, but we're not sort of – that sounded like they were being realistic about it.
Yeah, it was Adam Gilmore. He said, and I quote, "The first attempts at launches, they're always failed. So history is not on our side, and we do expect something to go wrong." And he's not wrong. I mean, if we look at SpaceX, Elon Musk's SpaceX, for example, they've blown up a lot of rockets. Mm. But of course, you learn from every failure, and that's why there's no people on these rockets. So if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. You know, $100 million is a lot of money to go up and smoke, but I'm sure that $100 million isn't for the actual rocket. It's more the engineering and facilities that they would have had to build and all of that. So, it's exciting that this sort of industry is happening here in Australia. And if you're an Australian company or the Defence Force that needs to put a satellite into orbit for whatever reason, you don't have to go to America. You don't have to go to Japan. You can come. You can just do it in house. So, which is really, really exciting.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, exciting's the word about this one for me too.
And we'll probably come back and cover this one in a couple of weeks when it does go off, and we'll let you know if it was a failure, if it was success, and what happens. We'll keep you in the loop. We'll let you know what goes on. Now, let's move on. It's time for our Two Ticks Town Talk. All right. This week, we're going to New South Wales, to the town of Oberon, which is located about 100 k's west of Sydney, almost directly west of Sydney. So this small town is pretty close to probably some of you listening at home. You just got to go, just hop, skip, and a jump over the Blue Mountains past Lithgow, which was the topic of one of our Two Ticks Town Talks from a while ago, and head on down towards this town of Oberon. In 2021 census, the town had a population of 3,319 people. So definitely not the smallest town we've covered, but still pretty small. Yep. The town was originally permanently settled in 1839 and was actually originally called Bullock Flat, but it was renamed to Oberon in 1863. I don't know why. I couldn't find an answer to that. Gold, very frustratingly, actually. So I'm sorry to all of you listeners. Gold was discovered in the Fish River nearby in 1823, leading inevitably to a massive population boost in the area.
Of course.
We're going to fast forward a fair bit because today the main industries are farming, forestry, and wood products. The town is home to the Borg manufacturing plant, where they manufacture wood products such as melamine boards, particle boards, and moldings, amongst a lot of other things. So if you're in the Sydney area and you have melamine, which is like the particle board that you see used in flat pack kitchens and flat pack furniture and things like that, if you have a melamine kitchen, there's a good chance it may have come from the town of Oberon. So being that the town is nestled in the Blue Mountains, they sometimes, well, quite usually, receive snowfall in the winter months, which now for our international listeners are like, so what? It snows. Big whoop. That's pretty rare in Australia. Australia is known for its more warm climate, let's say. So we don't get a lot of snow in a lot of places. You kind of have to be up in the mountains for it to snow. But it does snow there. So if you're in Sydney and you want to go for the snow, that might be a good place to go. Because, it's, of course, the town is nestled in the Blue Mountains, it doesn't just mean snow. There are other jewels located in these mountains. About 30 k's southeast of the town of Oberon, in the side of a mountain is a cave. And that entrance to that cave is one of 300 entrances to the Genoan limestone caves. These have date back to 340 million years ago, and it is the oldest known and dated cave system in the world.
Oh, in the world?
In the world. I think the caveat, the little asterisk there, is the oldest known and dated. So there's been a lot of research into these, into this specific cave, because it is a bit of a gem. So I'll tell you more about it. A little bit of history though. The Genoan caves are known to the Gundagari people, the local people of the area, as Binomial, which means the dark places, which kind of feels quite fitting for a cave, to be fair. Colonial exploration of the area in 1838, began in 1838, sorry, with the first recorded discovery of a local pastoralist, my goodness, James Whalen. He was not the first European to set eyes on the caves, though. That honor goes to James McCohen, an ex-convict and possibly an outlaw, reputed to have been using the valley and the cave as a bit of a hideout. So I would be a bit bitter if I was, the local farmer goes and says, oh, look, I discovered the caves, only to find out later on that actually you didn't. Obviously, the local Aboriginal people are known about it for bloody thousands of years, but to find out that a bush ranger had been living in there for a while, you kind of be a little bit annoyed. So I thought I would let him have a little bit of the limelight as well. Over the succeeding years, the pastoralist James Whalen and his brother Charles discovered several more openings, and they discovered what they called the Elder Cave in 1848. It was the first what they call dark cave explored by them. Dark cave, basically, as my understanding is, where natural light doesn't continue into that area. So you need to bring a light source with you.
Oh, okay.
In 1860, the Lucas Cave was discovered by Nicholas Irwin and George Whiting. Don't know if he's a descendant, if Steve Irwin is descended from him. Then they called that, instead of the Lucas Cave, they called that the New Cave, very original, and it was the largest. It was the largest of the caves, and it wasn't until 1866, though, that the caves were brought under direct government control. Unfortunately, in the meantime, things weren't going so great for the caves. In 1867, Jeremiah Wilson was appointed as keeper of the caves, and the caves were actually given the Aboriginal word Genoloan, which means high mountain, in 1884. So they were officially designated as that name. Despite the government control, however, the caves initially enjoyed very little protections, and in the early years, much damage was done, and that damage is still visible to this day, particularly in the Elder and the Lucas Caves, the first two that were discovered. And when we talk about damage, of course, we're talking about damage to the stalagmites and stalactites, as well as some of the other features in the caves. Bloody tourists, not being respectful. It wasn't until 1872 basically having free range of the caves and stealing bits and pieces actually became illegal, mostly to the efforts of John Lucas, the local member of parliament. And that's why they renamed New Cave to Lucas Cave. It bears his name to commemorate his part in the preservation of this fragile and irreplaceable environment. And in the 1880s, the Genoloan Cave began to emerge as a genuine tourist destination. By the turn of the century, it was becoming a reasonably well-established tourist destination. And in 1903, James Wilbird was appointed superintendent of the caves, also informally called the keeper of the caves, which sounds way better than superintendent, if I'm honest. And initially...
And more mysterious, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely more mysterious. If you called yourself, hello, my name's James, I'm keeper of the caves, you'd be like, whoa, what is that? He initiated one of the most successful periods of exploration. James Wilbird sounds to me like a genuine enthusiast. He must have loved this job because he, along with a couple of friends, Jack Edwards and Robert Bailey, pushed deeper into the caves and they discovered five more separate cave chambers. Or when I say caves, it's obviously one cave, but I guess the better word is chamber to the cave themselves, all within 18 months. So they must have been at this pretty regularly. And all of this exploration, of course, at this time period, was done by candlelight, which just gives me the heebie-jeebies, if I'm honest. The discoveries made by Wilbird and his friends truly elevated the caves to the status of a world-class cave system. And he remained superintendent until 1932, when he left due to the government's policy of compulsory retirement at the age of 65. So they basically dragged him out of there.
Dragged him out of his cave.
Out of his cave. Come on. You got to get out. You're too old.
He's hanging on to a stalactite or stalagmite from the ground. You can't take me.
This is not. I would imagine he would have.
I'm the keeper of the cave.
I'm the keeper of the cave. Today, there is more than 40 kilometers of multi-level passages. And as I said earlier, over 300 known entrances. And the complex is still being explored. And as I said, it is the oldest known and dated open cave system in the world. While large portions of the extensive cave system are only accessible to experienced cavers, especially those among the underground river system, 11 show caves have been developed. Developed into a regular tourist expositions, and they are open to the public. So 10 of these areas are called what we call the dark caves, and they're open for regular guided tours every day. They generally take about an hour or two. And these tour sizes, though, do vary a lot. For the Pool of Cerberus Cave, which has just the coolest name, you can only get 8 people at a time, so it is very intimate, much smaller cave, while the Lucas Cave, with its large chambers, can actually hold up to 65 people per tour. So a big difference in cave size. And the Cathedral Chamber, as part of the Lucas Cave, is very famous for its acoustics. And there have been a number of underground concerts that have taken place in this, in the chamber there, which is pretty cool. They also have concerts at an area called the Grand Arch, including the annual Carols in the Caves, which raises money for charity. Now,
presumably, they're all rock concerts. I'll leave now.
Look, I understand that this is not a visual medium, so it's going to be pretty hard for me to describe, you know, exactly the beauty of these caves. But I am going to send a data picture from Wikipedia, so this is under open license, and so we may use this picture for we'll probably link this picture in the show notes. We'll also link a link to the website, genoancaves.org.au. Because if you are listening to this and you're, especially if you're in the Sydney area and you go, oh, wow, yeah, that sounds cool, I want to go do that. Unfortunately, as of right now, the caves are closed.
How come?
More than 230 millimeters of rain fell overnight on Friday the 5th of April, which has sent water and debris right through the precinct. There's a number of buildings right outside, and there's been fairly significant damage to some of the structures. And at this time, the caves are still closed while they're cleaning everything up and everything like that. So, and repairing the damage that's been done. So check the website. They are giving regular updates about when it's going to be open again and everything like that. But I would say, even if you're not in the area, go and have a look at the website, because the pictures on the website, the pictures of these caves are absolutely phenomenal. And I really can't, I can't even describe them or do them justice. These caves are so old. There's also in a lot of, like, visibly in the walls, you can see a number of fossils. So from millions of years ago. So
they look like movie type caves. Like because of the age, the stalactites coming down from the ceiling and the stalagmites coming up to meet them are of such lengths that if you saw them in a movie, you'd think, you're sort of gilding the lily a bit there. That doesn't look quite real. But in reality, they are multiple drips in many aspects, and the lighting is really well done. The pictures do it just because I've actually been to Jenolan Caves. Sometime last century. But yes, I have actually been to Jenolan Caves and was blown away by just how impressive they were, with just so many features in them. And it's set up very well for tourists and going through. The lighting is great. And they did a thing where they had I can't remember the name of the chain because it was literally years ago. But they would do the thing of, okay, we're going to turn off all the lights now so that you can experience complete darkness, which was interesting to experience just absolute darkness as well. But, yeah, very beautiful.
Very beautiful. And I'm actually almost annoyed because I used to live in Sydney and I had no idea. This is definitely somewhere I would have gone for a day trip or maybe over the weekend or something like that, to go and experience. There are a lot of bushwalking tracks and things like that as well in the area. So there's plenty to do out here in the caves and around the town of Oberon. Blue Mountains is a beautiful area. We've covered it the last couple of weeks in our Tootsie's Town Talks. We've talked about it a bit. So if you are in Sydney and you're not going west and exploring just over the mountains, you're really missing out, and you should definitely pull your finger out and get in the car and get going.
Don't be like DK and stay away. Go and see the mountains.
Go and see. But if you are going to go to the caves, do have a look on the website. You can book on the website, I believe, as well. So, you know, don't waste your time. Go and have a look on the website.
Yeah, look, it's probably, I imagine, it's a hell of a lot more popular. Now, I was astounded to hear that they were the oldest. I know there was the qualifier of whatever you qualified it with, mapped, or there's something in there. Doesn't matter. I didn't realize that they were that old or that extensive. Yeah,
it's a huge complex. It's way bigger than I think people that have, well, like yourself, that have been there realize, because a lot of it isn't accessible to the public. There's a lot of smaller cabins and things like that. And as I said, there are still areas that they're sure there are other chambers that they can't quite get into, and or it's sort of too risky and things. And when I hear that, I always sort of wonder to myself, you know, if maybe like a small drone or something would be good to sort of get into areas where they can't get into. But then again, I'm, you know,
or I like squeeze, to squeeze young children to the cracks.
little children, maybe like a little snake robot or something like that.
Look, what, to chase the children so they run further into the cave?
That's right, and then you can corner them and chase them back out. It's a safety device. It's safe.
Exactly.
Look, I can appreciate the beauty.
Run, Timmy, run, Timmy.
I absolutely can appreciate the beauty in that. I'll go on the tour. But yeah, you will not find me in squeezing myself through through any small. They're just no thanks. But I no, do.
You and I share that, don't we?
Yeah, look, I absolutely appreciate the people in the past, like James Wilbird, that the keeper of the caves that did all of this amazing work, especially by the fact that that was done by candlelight. That just that's nightmare fuel in my mind. But hey, there are certain people that are, you know, they like that sort of thing. I don't. So
good luck to them.
Yeah, exactly. Good luck to them.
Oh, it was very interesting. Didn't know it was that old. Didn't know it was that big.
Now let's move on. The CSIRO has conducted a survey that finds most Australians want moderately paced energy transition, but are unwilling to pay more for it. I feel like I fit into this category. So a majority of Australians want the transition towards renewable energy to happen at a moderate pace, and most are unwilling to accept higher bills to pay for it. Most Australians remain supportive of the broader shift away from fossil fuels, and 4 out of 5 would at least tolerate living within 10 kilometres of a renewable energy infrastructure. That, to me, that's kind of upsetting that they would, at minimum, tolerate living 10 kilometres from renewable energy infrastructure. I know that's a vague term, renewable energy infrastructure, but I don't know. That kind of feels a bit of a NIMBY thing to do in my mind. Anyway, in what it said was the biggest poll of Australians' attitudes to the transition, the CSIRO found almost half of those surveys felt the shift should be moderately paced, while 40% wanted to be faster and more extensive. Just 13% of respondents preferred a low change scenario. A poll of 6,700 people from across the country between August and September last year found that affordability was the top priority for most Australians in the energy transition. About 82% of respondents ranked affordability in their top 3 priorities, and it was the top priority for 41% of respondents. By comparison, other priorities in the top 3 included Australia increasing its energy self-reliance at 71% and the reduction of carbon emissions at 56%. I'm surprised the reduction of carbon emissions isn't higher than 56%. According to the agency, most people are unwilling to pay more or risk blackouts to accelerate the move away from fossil fuels, which are still used, of course, to meet almost 2/3 of the power in Australia's main electricity grid. The CSIRO said 64% of respondents disagreed or strongly disagreed with the idea of paying more for electricity, and a figure that was only slightly lower at 62% for gas. At the same time, almost 60% of people were not prepared to risk more blackouts as part of the transition. Federal Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen said the report showed most people were optimistic about the energy transition, while opposition or resistance was low. Mr. Bowen, of course, that would be his takeaway. Mr. Bowen also acknowledged people's focus on affordability and said the government's plans to fast-track the development of firmed renewable energy would deliver the cheapest forms of new generation. He said the CSIRO's research finds that nearly 90% of Australians want high or moderate transition to renewables. And he continued, Labor's energy plan is backed by Australian experts who understand that our energy system needs, and we're developing cheap, clean, renewable energy in the grid, firmed by storage and gas right now. The CSIRO's research has also consistently shown renewables are the lowest cost form of energy, while nuclear is the most expensive. I think this is interesting. Some of these stats that came out of this report kind of surprised me in some way. I'm genuinely surprised that almost 90% of Australians surveyed felt like they wanted that moderate to accelerated pace of the energy transition. People are obviously worried about this, the future, the climate, you know, climate change and everything like that.
Let's go back. That 90, because that sort of threw me for a little bit of a loop when they talked about the 90.
Well, it's almost 90, because it's only 13% of people want a low change scenario, right? So 87% of respondents said that they were happy to tolerate a moderate or accelerated shift to
right. Yeah, okay, so that's put in the same category. I mean, that's a fairly broad category, though, isn't it?
It's very broad. If you've only got three options, yeah, you know, and you're combining two of them, it's very broad. Also, what does a moderate pace even mean?
Exactly.
What does an accelerated pace even mean? I do feel kind of... I don't know exactly what the questions were, so it can be hard to interpret the data without knowing exactly what the sort of questions were. Because if you were asked, you know, should Australians transition toward renewable energy and at what pace do you think it should be? Low, moderate, accelerated. That's, I think most people will probably kind of go, middle of the road seems okay. But if you're not putting in genuine timeframes on those sort of things, it can make it a bit harder. I do believe this survey was like a telephone survey of people, so that kind of like muddies the water a little bit as well. How do you feel about this? What do you think about this report?
Look, it didn't surprise me. What they say, 82% of respondents ranked affordability in their top three priorities. I think that's hardly surprising given the cost of living mess dumped on us in our laps by the very same bureaucracies that are intent on spurring us on at all costs to this global virtue signaling. So I was not surprised to hear that a lot of people were saying, what's it actually going to cost us? Probably wasn't surprised to hear that there was a general acceptance of moving towards the renewables and green energies. But what I found interesting was it reminded me a little bit of those prediction sites where you have to put the money on the line. So when they've done things where they've people have, you know, make a bet or make a forecast about what's going to happen. Now, when there's no money involved, people will forecast a particular way, but when they actually have to risk their money, then the forecasts tend to become like slightly more conservative, slightly more considered, and a lot more realistic. So I couldn't help but be reminded of that with this when it was, what would you like, but you have to pay for it. And so I, that's a little sting in the tail. If it's coming out of my pocket, it's very different to saying, oh, yes, the government can just pay for it and they'll just get their money from wherever. So I was heartened to hear that. Yeah, I want to continue moving closer and closer to more green energy, but I have a probably different... A different view of the time frame that's involved in this, because it's, I don't know, we do seem to be getting pushed into it, and I know the reason given is, well, you know, we're on the edge of this disaster and everything, and a lot of people probably won't like me saying that in that way, but oh, stuff you. We're all entitled to our opinions. I think there's just a real heavy push, particularly in a lot of the developed economies to move this way. And I know I've got a little bit of a cynical, skeptical side about the profitability of that for a lot of people. However, I do support that principle because, you know, we can get rid of pollution, we can get rid of burning a whole lot of fossil fuel for energy and move into clean energies. I happen to consider nuclear a clean energy. But if we can move that way towards all those clean energies, I ultimately think it's a good thing. But yeah, I enjoyed the realistic response on this. I also thought it was interesting, and this again might be my slightly conspiratorial side, where there was a comment there saying at the same time almost 60% of people were not prepared to risk more blackouts as part of the transition. And I thought it's interesting how this appears, not definite, but appears to be being weaved into this narrative along with the, maybe there might be some higher costs. When the original sales pitch for all this was that it would essentially be seamless and cheaper. So I don't know, there's a little flag went up on that. As I said, it might be my conspiratorial side, but it's like, you know, full steam ahead. This is going to be tremendous. It's going to be cheap. It's going to be easy to go to it. And then the rubber hits the road. It's like, there might be a higher risk of blackouts, and it's not going to be as cheap just yet, but trust us, it's going to be cheaper in the future. And we're actually going to have to change a whole lot of things in the landscape, and we might have to charge it. Just all the little qualifiers get in. Yeah, you're sort of sold the idea, but then all these little details, they're all the little devils in the detail. Is that being a bit too cynical, do you think?
I think there's definitely something in that. The goalposts seem to have moved.
Yes.
I think... frustrated. I think a lot of Aussies are getting frustrated with this a bit as well. When we look beyond our shores at the biggest polluters, or the countries that are at most fault, let's say, for the climate crisis. Australia is obviously, it's good for us to transition into a clean energy economy. But our share of the damage, let's call it, is a drop in the bucket compared to other countries. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't need to change. We do. I do think that we should be able to transition reasonably quickly without a lot of pain. And that's kind of what's been sold to a lot of us. But that's also not what's happening. And I don't know where the disconnect has really come from. Maybe it's that some of these technologies aren't as mature as we'd probably thought. I think renewables are really, really good, but there's obviously some major downsides to do with, you know, like solar is absolutely fantastic until the sun goes down. Wind is really, really good until the wind stops blowing, which I understand with wind energy, you generally put it in areas that are pretty consistent. So wind is a lot more consistent than say solar is. But there is a certain consistent drop in energy production with wind during a nighttime event, which is when most Australians are using their energy. So I don't think it's necessarily that the technologies themselves aren't mature. I think it's that the storage capabilities aren't mature enough. And that's where things like nuclear come into the question, can come into the picture and sort of pick up some of that slack. At the moment, that's not what's happening. We're demolishing coal-fired power plants, which I think is a good thing. But we don't really have a good long-term solution to take up their slack. Yep. We're transitioning without a plan is kind of how it feels.
Good description. It does feel that way. Despite all the sales talk, perfect. Transitioning without a plan, that's how I feel. Now, that might be inaccurate.
Yeah, I almost don't like to say that because I feel like that's probably more inaccurate than true. But that's how it feels, I think, to most lay people, that, you know, they see on the news, oh, this massive coal-fired power plant is closing down. And it's being replaced with, oh, nothing. Wait, what? How is this going to work? Or we've seen a number of shutdown plants that were supposed to have already shut down already that are continuing on because there isn't something that's going to replace it, you know. And the government also, and this kind of grinds my gears, is very famously Scott Morrison said, if you don't like the increase in diesel and fuel prices overall, you should have bought an electric car. Well, Scott Morrison, if we all have electric cars, our power grid is going to collapse in on itself. We can barely keep the lights on as we are right now without burning rocks out of the ground. So how are we going to do? How are we going to get everyone to drive an electric car, which, you know, I think is part of the future. I think there will be a lot more electric cars. We're already seeing the market shifting in that direction. And again, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think that the change in pace and what consumers want, what the average everyday Australian on the street, when you stop and ask them, like this survey did, and say, hey, would you like an electric car? Do you want solar panels on your roof? Do you want clean energy? They say yes to all of those things. And they go, cool, we'll write that down and we'll give it to the report to the government. And the government go, yeah, that's really good. Where's the plan? How are we putting this into action? What's the realistic view of this actually happening in a moderate to accelerated transition phase? This is what kind of annoyed me, because the federal climate change and energy minister, Chris Bowen, chimed in on this, and he just gave us the most bland politician non-statement ever. He goes, Labor's energy plan is backed by Australian experts who understand our energy system's needs, and we're delivering cheap, clean, renewable energy to the grid. That's not true. They may have an Australian experts who have created the energy plan. I would like to hope so. Quite honestly, I'd be very concerned if they were creating an energy plan without expertise. But they're not delivering cheap energy. They're not delivering clean energy because they're burning gas and they're burning coal. So that's not true either. They are renewing a small amount of renewable energy. Less than, I think it's a third of the energy in Australia is created by renewable energy. And almost all of that is used during the daylight hours. So I don't know. I feel like everyone that I talk to is and being continuously fed this idea of we're transitioning to renewables, and everyone's like on board with it. Everyone's like, yeah, cool. Like, what do we need to do? How do we need to do it? Don't make me uncomfortable because you've told us that we don't need to be. And now they're like, oh, well, you know, we might have rolling blackouts. And it's like, well, sorry, what?
Exactly.
This wasn't part of the deal, man. You were going to sort this out. Oh, well, we have to keep burning gas. Okay, well, what's the plan to replace the gas plant? Like, so we're getting rid of the coal plants, we're going to build the gas plants. Okay, for our American listeners, when we say gas, we're talking about natural gas, LPG type situation, not petroleum. So we're replacing the coal plants with gas plants. What's the replacement for the gas plants? Don't have one. Realistically, like, there isn't a plan here as far as I can see right now. Not a realistic plan. There's a lot of pie in the sky plans for massive solar farms and huge lithium battery banks and things like that, but they're unrealistic because it's not going to happen. You can't scale these things up to the size that we need them in a realistic time frame, and it's going to cost a huge amount of money. So it's kind of like, and that's where, you know, people go, well, oh, nuclear would be really good and it could just slot straight in. The problem there, of course, is, as we know, nuclear plants take 30 years and $40 billion to build. So that's not really going to work either. But, you know, as the saying goes, the best time to plant a tree was 5 years ago. Second best time to plant a tree is today. So I feel like we're going around in circles a lot politically with this energy transition talk, and nothing's getting done. And they're letting They're letting industry get on with it. Like, they're letting the energy companies do what they're doing. And what they're doing is trying to make the most money because they're businesses, right? That's just capitalism, right? Yeah. So they're like, we're going to shut down this coal plant because it's old and it needs to be retired and we don't want it anymore. And the New South Wales government freaks out and goes, if you get rid of that, we're going to have rolling blackouts in Sydney. So you can't shut it down.
Yeah.
And now we're going to have workplace accidents because the place is falling apart. You know, it just feels like in every direction you look, there's like a dumpster fire going on. And then you have the Federal Minister for Energy standing there going, everything's great. And it's not just, I'm not just singling Chris Bowen out. His predecessors in the last government and the governments before him have done the exact same thing. So this isn't like, I'm not bashing Labor here. The Labor and the LNP are both in this bin together. They've both created this monster. And bloody that's what's so frustrating. And then the Greens will come in with some pie in the sky thing. So they're no better. And they'll go, oh, we'll put windmills on every house. And it's like, that's ridiculous. Like, oh, it's so frustrating because I don't, honestly, I'm saying this, I don't have the answer. I'm not an expert on energy policy. And I'm not pretending to be one. But it's frustrating as a layperson sitting, looking at what's going on, at what they're saying, and what's actually happening. And all I know is my power bill has doubled in the last 5 years.
Yes.
And I have solar on my roof.
Insanely. Exactly right.
So my footprint's very small.
Yep. Bloody hell. And that's the bottom line. And that's the real thrust of this story. It doesn't matter all the bloody sales bullshit we've been fed. You look at what's coming out of your pocket, and it's very different to the promises.
It is. I actually have my power bill here in front of me. Now, I live in Queensland, which means I am with an energy company called Ergon. Ergon is a state-owned energy provider, right? They are owned by the Queensland government and, as a result, by every Queenslander, right? So this isn't – they're not supposed to be – they are a for-profit company, but they're a state-run company, if that makes sense. Yep. Our energy rate – we're on the general residential tariff, is 30 cents a kilowatt. Flat rate. Doesn't matter when you use it.
Well, now, that's not bad.
You say that. I think this is very high. 4 years ago, my usage, my rate was about 14 to 16 cents, thereabouts. Our feed-in tariff was a lot lower, but so was the rate that we were being charged. And I know that that is low. That 30 cents a kilowatt is low for Australia. And that's what blows my mind. And of course, everything in my house runs off electricity. I don't have a gas bill as well. And I know if you live down in those horrible foreign lower states, you'll have heating requirements. I don't understand what that is, but your house get cold, God. Apparently. And so you burn a lot of gas to keep them warm. We have the opposite problem up here. Maybe we can take some of our warm down to you guys. And as a result, you have these massive, massive bills. So if you're listening to this and you are in a horrible place like Victoria, I empathize with you. I feel terrible for you. And the only person you can blame is Dan Andrews, naturally.
I'd love to blame Dan, he's just one of the many contributors. Your point about this has been current Labor, previous Liberal, Labor before that. This has been an energy problem that's just been constantly kicked down the road while all we get is bloody green platitudes. And as you and I have both said, you know, we're more than... you and I would love to see, like, if I could flick a switch tomorrow and we go to green, clean energy all round, I'd flick it in an instant. But that's not where we are, and that's not the reality of the situation. And yeah, look, I don't know which way we go from here, because unfortunately, we seem to be relying on the bureaucrats. And I don't have a lot of faith when it comes to that.
This is, look, this is, and this is the problem, right? Is it's a bureaucratic problem. It's a very complicated problem, and I'm not trying to trivialize it. And I don't think there is a silver bullet. I think it's a multifaceted problem, and I think different solutions are going to work in different places. But I think that complexity does make it difficult for the CSIRO, for the energy ministers, you know, to throw them a bone. I do think it is kind of complicated for them to talk about it because it is so complicated. But as a result, they keep feeding us the same sort of, I don't want to say crap, but the same sort of lines and not really give us any meat to fully understand exactly what's going on. And the average Australian's getting higher and higher bills, and it's not helping the cost of living crisis. And I think people are going to get really fed up, and there's going to be some pushback. And I think it's starting to happen now, as we've seen the nuclear thing has become very politicized and very frustratingly so, actually. Look, I don't know how this is going to end, but I just feel like the average Aussie, the average punter, is going to be the one holding the baby. And you know, things are probably going to get more expensive, unfortunately, especially if there's a transfer. I do think if there's a change in government in the next federal election, I actually think things probably will get worse.
Why do you say that?
If already there's been a lot of talk about how nuclear is going to become a campaign promise by Dutton. And I think I do think that's the wrong way to go. It's just the timeframes just aren't going to work. I wish we had nuclear already, but you can't just, you know, pull one out of thin air. They're all bespoke, and we've spoken about this before. And the small reactor technology isn't quite where it kind of has been.
It's not the
It's been touted as that it's ready, but it's not. And I really think that Dutton is going to continue to kick that can down the road. He's going to spend a lot of money doing all the stuff for nuclear, and he's going to bang on about nuclear, and nothing's going to happen. And then we're going to be left in the exact same place 5 years down the road, which is going to make it even worse, because then we're going to have to move to an accelerated plan because, you know, we've signed these climate agreements and da 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 da. So I think Dutton's probably the worst case scenario for this situation because he's just going to do nothing about it. Like the previous LNP governments have done in the past. Like, it's kind of what they do. They make a lot of noise and they go, oh, you know, Labor's making everyone's cost of living bad. And it's like, well, actually, it was your previous government that caused the inflation. And then you handed the reins over to the next guy and we're like, yeah, it's your problem now. So, you know, there's a lot of that kind of going on, and it's so frustrating sitting here seeing it happen in real time, just going, can you just fucking get on with your work? Like, can you just do your job instead of just going around in circles? It's so frustrating. Anyway.
Yeah.
We should move on. Going on our plans.
I feel so close to you now, DK.
I'm losing my mind over here. Let's move on to hopefully some good things in this week in Australian history. I've come from a land
down under. Okay, this week in Australian history, we're covering the 12th to the 18th of April. April 12th, 1835, the convict transport George III sinks in D'Entre Castro Channel. 139 male convicts drown. 1851, between 7th and 12th of April, 4 ounces of gold were won at what would become the township of Ophir in New South Wales. The first payable gold to be won in New South Wales and in Australia. We've mentioned this before, but it's an interesting terminology that you've to be won. Like, it's rather than found or discovered, it was, you know, gold to be won.
Yeah, I wonder why they – I know we talked about this before, but I can't recall if we ever came to the bottom of why they called it that.
No, just that just when we looked into it, that just seemed to be,
So maybe it's like a tax thing. Oh, I won it. Where'd you get that gold from? Yeah. I won it. Yeah. From where? Oh, you know, the river. Can't tax me on it. I don't know. Maybe it's something to do with that. I don't know.
I wonder. Huh. 1924, the battlecruiser HMAS Australia is scuttled off Sydney Heads. Do you know anything about that one, DK? And also, I want to add to, what's the process for scuttling something as big as a battle cruiser with regards to sort of, you know, secrecy and what gets removed about it and that?
So this wasn't particularly secret, the scuttling. Basically, this ship was more or less.
No, I meant the actual, like, not the actual scuttling, but technology that might be on the ship.
Oh, yeah. So when they scuttle a ship, at first it'll be the HMS Australia was alongside at Garden Island, which if you've been to Sydney, the big Navy base in the middle of the city near the Harbour Bridge, it was alongside there, and they basically go in and remove any sensitive documentation, sensitive technologies, all that kind of stuff. I don't really think there was probably too much on the HMAS Australia, this particular HMAS Australia, because we have had a number of ships that were called that, that would have been particularly sensitive technologies at the time, because this ship was more or less very much obsolete by the time she was scuttled. And a lot of, they basically remove anything of value, and anything particularly that is, well, especially now, I'm not sure so much then, but anything that can be harmful to the marine environment, because generally when you're scuttling a ship, you're sort of making like an artificial reef. So anything that's particularly dangerous, all the fluids, any oil, the bilge, like everything has to be pumped out. Even today, they'll remove certain materials that may be found to be harmful, like things like asbestos, which you wouldn't think asbestos would be particularly harmful to in a marine environment, but they'll remove it because they don't want that to contaminate the area and things like that. So there's a lot of that goes on. Apparently with the HMS Australia scuttling, there were a lot of Royal Australian Navy personnel that would go on board for private collectors and kind of remove little bits and pieces. And there were a lot of stuff that was kind of used, like taken and sold as souvenirs and things like that. Which I would imagine kind of happens every time there's a scuttling, you know, people just take a few things and be like, oh, look, you know, this bolt's from the HMS Australia or whatever. And then they tow it out, and there's different ways to do it. These days you generally use an explosive charge, but there is a thing called a seacock, which is in the hull of the ship. There'll be a valve that'll basically allow you to open it, and the ship will start flooding, essentially. The seacocks, though, do take quite a long time to go, because you're basically just turning it. Imagine turning a tap on to flood your kitchen. It'll happen, but it's going to take a while.
Right. Okay.
So they'll normally blow some explosive charges in the bottom of the ship that'll kind of, you know, flood it a bit quicker. Because a ship this size, even still, takes quite a while to sink. So, so that's how they do it.
Oh, okay. I thought you'd know. April 13th, 1829, Melbourne's first post office opens. 1841, the first photograph was taken in Australia by a visiting naval captain, Augustine Lucas. Doesn't appear as that photograph's still around, unfortunately, so I can't provide a link. I could describe it through the power of interpretive dance. However, that wouldn't work well with a podcast. So, wait till we get the visual. 1855, the University of Melbourne was established by an Act of the Parliament of Victoria. April 14th, 1870, gold is discovered in Gulgung, New South Wales, sparking a major gold rush in the area. God, we've had plenty of bloody gold rushes over the last centuries. 1986, the second trial of former Attorney General of Australia and High Court Judge Lionel Murphy begins in Sydney, accused of attempting to pervert justice, and he was eventually acquitted. Now, Murphy was an interesting bloke, and he was a bit of like a social activist as well when he was a politician, and also when he was on the High Court. So look, I'll put a link to his Wikipedia entry. But here's the thing that I thought was amusing, an excerpt of, and this gives you an indication of his character. When he was a Attorney General under the Whitlam government, he used an existing provision of the Marriage Act to establish the Civil Marriage Celebrant Program. So it said the Civil Celebrant Program is almost entirely the result of one man's vision. Murphy himself told me the story of how he was opposed by his own staff, the public service, and his fellow members of Parliament and the officials of the Labour Party, and he defied it all. And on July 19th, 1973, in the dead of night, he typed the first appointment himself, found the envelope and stamp, walked to a post box and posted himself. And there was a lady, Lois Darcy, who carries the honour of being the first genuinely independent civil celebrant. So although it was a radical move at the time, the program proved very successful. In 2015, 74% of marrying couples in Australia chose a civil marriage celebrant, and the program broadened to include secular funerals, namings, and other ceremonies which celebrated the landmarks of human existence. And Murphy took an enthusiastic interest in this program, sending telegrams of congratulations to the first several hundred couples married by civil celebrants, and would often unexpectedly turn up uninvited to weddings performed by celebrants just to delight in his achievement. imagine getting married, and the Attorney General turns up and say, oh, just wanted to check it out, see how it's going.
Just pop in, mate. You're not getting any of the bar tab, all right?
So I thought that was a funny little anecdote about him. April 15th, 1903, electric trams begin operating in Bendigo in Victoria. 1944, Fred Patterson is elected to the Parliament of Victoria, representing the seat of Bowen. We were talking about earlier on.
You mean the Parliament of Queensland? You said the Parliament of Victoria. Parliament of Queensland, yeah.
Oh, did I say? Oh, God. Well, this is a Freudian slip. Well, actually, it's not a Freudian slip at all. It's just a stuff up. Okay, so elected to the Parliament of Queensland, representing the seat of Bowen, where we talked about earlier with the rocket. He remains the only member of the Communist Party of Australia to ever be elected to an Australian Parliament. That particular Communist Party finished in 1991, although there's another one that exists today under the name of the Communist Party of Australia, but it was previously called the Socialist Party of Australia. So, yeah, not surprised to find that the Queenslanders elected a communist. 1991. Actually, I am a bit surprised, to be perfectly frank. 1991, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody hands down its findings. 1999, a massive hailstorm hits Sydney, with most of the damage being centred on the eastern suburbs. April 16, Harry Chevalle, the first Australian to achieve the rank of general, is born in Tabulum in New South Wales. 2003, the Australian Army's Special Operations Command begins a four-day chase of the North Korean ocean freighter Pong Su off the coast of Lawn, Victoria. The incident began when heroin was smuggled from Pong Su onto an Australian beach, and Australian military forces subsequently, after the chase, boarded the Pong Su in Australian territorial waters. It was suspected of being involved in smuggling almost 125 kilograms, 267 pounds of heroin, with an estimated street value of $160 million. It was registered in Tuvalu just a flag of convenience. They arrested a few people, and after being confiscated, the ship was destroyed in 2006.
It should be said, it wasn't just destroyed. It was used as a... Or it wasn't just scuttled like we were talking about earlier. It was used as a target for military aircraft.
Oh, so
it was blown up. Yeah, it was blown up. Officially, they call it that it was scuttled, but it wasn't. It was blown up. Yeah, which is pretty cool. They used it as a couple of RAF F-111s, the Aardvark, came and dropped some bombs on it and then shot at it. And yeah, the Navy had a couple of pot shots and things like that. But yeah, it was the bombs that basically did it in.
Like a cat playing with a mouse.
Yeah.
Only with a little bit more high explosives involved. April 17th, 1935, Australia's national airline Qantas operates its first overseas passenger flight from Brisbane to Singapore. 2003, the Woomera Immigration Reception and Processing Centre near Woomera in South Australia is closed, with detainees transferred to the Baxter Immigration Reception and Processing Centre near Port Augusta. 2005, the Bali Nine, a group of nine people later convicted of attempting to smuggle heroin, speaking of smuggling heroin, from Indonesia to Australia, into Australia, are arrested in Indonesia. I can't remember if all of them were executed. I know a few of them were.
I think it was only the ringleaders.
Yeah.
Andrew Chan, and I can't remember the other guy's name.
Yeah, and the other ones, I don't know if they're still in jail, but yeah, not a good idea.
No.
April 18th, 1831. In fact, this finishes us off. So the last bit of this week in Australian history, April 18th, 1831, the Sydney Morning Herald, Australia's oldest newspaper, is first published in Sydney, New South Wales. Now, the Herald website has this description of its first editions, which, in the context of modern media, gives me a bit of a chuckle. The front page carried nothing but notices and advertisements, with news buried at the end of page two. Its editorial policies were based upon principles of candor, honesty, and honor. We have no wish to mislead, no interest to gratify by unsparing abuse or indiscriminate approbation. So, yeah, I thought that was a bit amusing.
Hmm.
All right, so time to sit back and relax with a 4X bottle top quiz. Settle in, DK, and crack that beer. All right, both these questions are remembering when two Aussie icons begin. And I'll give you a couple of years leeway on this, because sometimes there's those things that you guess, 2024, but the answer's 2022. And, but if you nail it, I'll be impressed.
Oh, no pressure.
Yeah. And you'll know both of them. Okay, the first one. In what year did Neighbours first air on Australian TV?
Oh, we were talking about this just the other day, I'm sure. I think it was one of the... Oh, no. Maybe it was...
We might have been
mentioning it. I'm sure we talked about Neighbours. It must have been on... This Week in Australian History or something. I'm certain we talked about it recently, but anyway. When did it start? What year did it start?
What year did it first air?
Oh, I feel like it's got to be... I want to say... My gut says, the early 80s. I'm just trying to think of the hairstyles of everyone. It was because I've seen some of those early like snippets from when it was like really, really early on.
That's a good reasoning.
Yeah, and there was, you know, someone dies or something and they go, oh, remember that they were on Neighbours and they did this, and you know, zip back 40 years. I'm sure it's the 80s or it might be the late 70s. I don't know. I have no idea when it would have
in the 80s. Go with your gut.
I'm going with the 80s.
That's what I would suggest, yeah.
I don't know. I'll say 1984.
Oh, in terms of the parameters, whether I said before, I'll give that to you as 1985.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, good. Hey, look, gosh, that was when you said that about the hairstyles, I thought that's a good way to sort of try and cast your mind back.
Well, it wasn't new when I was a kid, and I was born at the end of the 80s. So, like, it wasn't new then. It had been around for a while, so.
Yeah, I thought it had started before you. Yeah, because you had, like, you think of that Scott and Charlene wedding. And
that's
she had,
right, you know, yeah, the big hair and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, this one, I can tell you there's no chance I would have got this. In what year did Vegemite hit the Australian market?
Oh, I was reading an article about Vegemite the other day, and I can't remember what it was about now that I said that. I want to say maybe it was their 100th anniversary or something. I don't know. Maybe? I don't know. When Vegemite. So Vegemite is made from yeast extract, and originally it was made, I don't know if it still is, it might be, I don't know, but it was originally made with basically the yeast cake that's left over from making beer would then be, I think they just like cook it, and that's what Vegemite is. I'm not 100% certain.
I've never understood that.
Yeah, I don't know if they add anything else to it, but I'm pretty sure that's like
salt.
Possibly. I'm not really sure. But I know they just kind of cook that. And the Vegemite thing came from the UK, where they have Marmite. And that's been around. And New Zealand has their own Marmite. It's different to the British one. I actually think the New Zealand Marmite is probably like the strongest out of them all. Like, it's pretty full on, that one. Maybe it's just what you're used to. I don't really like the British Marmite. I like Vegemite.
I haven't had the New Zealand one. I'm with you. The Marmite doesn't do, British Marmite doesn't do anything for me. I'm not a huge Vegemite boy, but when I've had the difference between the two, it's chalk and cheese, Vegemite all the way.
If you ever get a chance, try the New Zealand one. It looks, the can, or the jar, I should say, is the same as like the Vegemite jar. It's just got a different logo. Whereas the British one has that, like, I don't know. It's like a different shape. It's I want to say more round, but jars are round, so it's not a good description. I don't know. I can't even describe it. Anyway, when was it? I swear I read an article that said it was the anniversary, were they releasing a new product or something? Oh, I can't remember. It's got to be, I'm going to say, the 1920s, surely. Like, it's 100 years old, surely.
Yeah.
Actually, no. Hang on. I know it's definitely over 100 years old, because a couple of years ago, it must have been their 100th anniversary, because I bought a special edition jar, and it's like black and it's in a little box, and I have it in the top of my cupboard. So, and that's probably maybe 2-3 years ago I bought that. So they must be, it must be from like the 1921, 1922, 1923, something like that. No, it must be more than 2 years. So it must be 1921 or 1922 that they came out.
Well, I've got 1923 down here, and as we know, the Forex bottle tops don't lie, but...
Oh, maybe I bought it sooner than I realised, not that long ago, I don't know.
In anticipation of, so yes, that's what I was saying, trust your gut. You see, your memory was good on that one.
Boom, 100 years old. Wow, that was a lot of reasoning.
Both of them.
I cannot believe I had actually completely forgot about that jar of Vegemite in my cupboard. I should go and have a look, make sure it's not gone all festive.
So, what are you going to do with it?
I don't know. I just bought it and put it in the cupboard, and I've forgotten about it. So, I'm not sure.
Do you eat much Vegemite?
My kids do. I don't really. Every now and again, I'll have Vegemite toast for breakfast. I don't eat breakfast very often, but sometimes if I do, I'm feeling it, I'll have Vegemite toast with the kids. But they eat a lot of Vegemite. Like, we go through a big jar of Vegemite probably once a month. Like, it gets consumed very regularly in this house.
So you potentially, you have the potential, and I'm not quite sure what you would do as be a mysterious dad or something to sort of start dropping hints about the special jar of Vegemite. check that it's not bloody poisonous so you don't sort of poison your kids again. Just make sure it's all right and then just sort of start dropping hints and pique their curiosity and see what happens when you bring it out. And this is sort of like, this is a vintage thing. And I don't know. You're pretty good at spinning stuff.
I don't know if that's an insult or if that's
a compliment. I can imagine you doing the dad thing and just spinning this bloody tale about this video, particularly if it gets to the point where they're actually pressuring you to reveal it to them and you're reluctantly sharing this special jar of Vegemite with them.
I think it's the same. I think it's just the same. I had to Google it because obviously we're recording right now, so I can't just run off. But it was, I'll send you a picture of it. It's a very fancy looking jar. Yeah, it's like, I said it was black, but it's not. It's like gold. It's very fancy.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. That's very different. That's something you could just sort of get your wife to just sort of drop in with earshot. Oh, is that the regular Vegemite or the special one?
The special one. I don't know if I want to open it though. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. Maybe I should keep it.
What are you going to keep it so it increases 20% in value? And what goes up?
Yeah, that's it. It's not.
It's up to $7.
I don't know. I'll put it somewhere and my grandkids will find it. And they'll be like, wow, look at this. And they'll open it up and it'll still be good, I'm sure. The ancient Vegemite. That's it. The jars of Vegemite today are made. They only ever made one batch back 100 years ago and they're just scooping it out ever since. So, listen. On that bombshell, thank you so much for listening to another Australia Talks, the official podcast of the r/Australian subreddit. If you have any feedback or suggestions for topics, please get in touch with us on the r/Australian subreddit or email us at australiansubreddit@proton.me. We'd also be grateful if you could subscribe and give us an honest review, as that helps us out with the algorithm immensely. Otherwise, join us next week for another episode of Australia Talks. And remember, at r/Australian, we are Australian. Thanks for listening and tell your mum I love her.
Thanks, TK. See you later.
See ya.